Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is 2020-1247. Christina Cruz et al. Versus the English Nanny and Governess School et al. For the appellant, Mr. Patakos.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Peter Patakos, and I represent appellants Christina Cruz and Heidi Kaiser. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal. I would like to begin this morning by emphasizing that there are two things we are not asking this court to do on this appeal. First, we are not asking this court to hold that attorney's fees for post-verdict work must be awarded in every case where a jury finds that a plaintiff should, as part of a punitive damages award, be compensated for their legal fees and expenses. Secondly, despite appellee's repeated incantation of the term American rule in their briefing, this appeal does not seek to overturn or otherwise change the American rule. To the contrary, we are merely asking this court to affirm a key aspect of an exception to the American rule that is so well established that it could well be considered a part of the American rule itself. Indeed, there is no dispute among the parties or the courts of Ohio that where a jury awards attorney's fees as part of a punitive damages award against a party that is found to have committed malicious tortious conduct, it is within the sound discretion of the trial court to determine the proper amount of that fee award. And there is no reasonable dispute that under this court's clear precedent, as stated in, for example, the Digital and Analog Design Corp decision, these awards need to be, and this is a quote, adequate both to compensate the plaintiff for his attorney's fees and to fulfill the punitive and deterrent purpose of the exemplary damages awarded. This is a well-established principle of the common law that the legislature has not only left undisturbed for nearly 150 years, but has deliberately taken care to protect, as we see clearly in the damages cap statute, which specifically excludes fees from counting against the cap. And consistent with the twin purpose of fee awards, to compensate plaintiffs and deter and punish defendants, this court has, for good reason, never drawn a distinction between fees incurred before the verdict was obtained and fees incurred in defending that verdict, whether in the trial court or on appeal. Indeed, both the appellees and the 8th District panel below acknowledge that post-verdict fees are rightly available in other circumstances where trial courts make fee awards, such as—
Can I interrupt you? How does that work when there is a contingency fee agreement? So if the plaintiff prevails and there's a contingency agreement, the attorneys get a percentage of that amount, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And
yes.
That's regardless of whether the trial court decides to award attorney fees. And so and if there is a punitive damage award, then there's a percentage of that also goes to the attorney, correct?
Your Honor, the factor of whether there is a contingency fee is a well-established part of this procedure. That is one of the factors under this court's precedent and under professional conduct rule 1.5 that is analyzed by the court.
But I'm just trying to figure out. So there's a percentage of the compensatory fees, there's a percentage of the punitive damages, compensatory and punitive damages, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so, and the trial court may or may not award attorney's fees.
That is generally within the trial court's discretion.
So if the trial court does award attorney fees, do the attorneys get the attorney's fees plus the percentage of the compensatory and punitive damage awards?
Well, I think an important point to make here, I think there are several complications in answering that question. I think the first point I want to make here is that The fee award is for the client. It is intended to compensate the plaintiff to make sure that the plaintiff's recovery is not reduced by whatever amount the plaintiff had to compensate their attorneys. That is the first prong of the important purpose of these awards. And I suppose whether which portion of the any fee award would go to the client would depend on the specific agreement between the plaintiffs. I think there are some agreements that would say the fee award goes entirely to the client. Some fee awards would say it goes to the attorney. And you know, there are many many different permutations that could happen in between.
So there's a possibility, depending on the agreement between the attorney and his or her client, that the client could also get a percentage of the attorney's fees. There could be a percentage divvy between the client and the attorney, depending on the agreement, regardless of what amounts are recovered.
Absolutely, Justice Stewart. That is absolutely the fact. And again, I think the more important point is that the fee award is intended to ensure that the plaintiff's recovery is not ultimately reduced. I think another important point to make about this contingency fee factor is that you're analyzing it in the context of Professional Conduct Rule 1.5, which really, Professional Conduct Rule 1.5 is directed at what fee is reasonable for a lawyer to charge the client. This really has nothing to do with a defendant. It has nothing to do with a defendant paying a fee award pursuant to punitive damages. We're talking about what is an attorney allowed to charge a client? And I think it's important to note here that is being the eighth factor. Courts typically find the existence of a contingency fee to justify an upward adjustment to the total fee that the attorney can collect from the client attorney took on substantial risk.
No, I get that. Let me finish the second part of my question. So in this particular case, there were two appeals at the Court of Appeals level, correct? And then
correct.
This appeal. So correct. In the second, after the first appeal, you went back to the trial court, asked for attorney's fees that included attorney's fees to defend the first appeal, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And I would add
Okay, let me finish asking. So then what about the second appeal attorney's fees? And then what about this appeal's attorney's fees? Can you go back to the trial court to ask for both of those? If successful, yes, of course, obviously.
Yes, well, we would say that regardless of what this court rules, this case will get remanded back to the trial court either way for a redetermination of the fees consistent with the other part of the Eighth District's order, where the Eighth District said that there was a portion of the fee award that the trial court issued in its last order that needs to be reassessed and that more evidence needs to be taken. So yes, this would go back to the trial court. Yes.
And so if you're successful, can you get asked for, if we agree that appellate attorney fees should be calculated, then you could also ask for, at the trial court's discretion, getting the attorney's fees for both the second appeal and this appeal.
Yes, correct? Your Honor, that is our position.
Okay.
And we would ask for those fees. I mean, we've certainly worked very hard at every level of this appeal.
Right. I'm not questioning your work. I was just trying to understand your line of thinking. Thank you. I get it now. Thank you.
Mr. Patakos, Justice Bruner here. Let's say you have a 40% agreement if there's a recovery, and then you are awarded, there's an award of attorney's fees, and that goes to the client. Wouldn't that go to the client entirely as an offset against your 40%? Because you can't split fees with a non-attorney.
I just believe it depends on what would be in the agreement.
But you were mentioning that there'd be a split between the client and your firm, potentially, just if this were a theoretical situation, of the award of attorney's fees. But they belong to the client, correct?
the attorney's fee award, the attorney fee award does belong to the client. That's what the case law says. But you could enter a contingency fee award. You could enter a contingency fee agreement with a client where the amount recovered pursuant to a fee award could potentially be shared with the client and the attorneys.
Okay.
Counsel, Justice Fisher here. What rule do you want us to write? Because sometimes on appeal, even the appellee may win some points, may lose some points, may cross appeal, win, lose some points. But assuming you still kept your compensatory damages and punitives, doesn't the trial court have to determine how much of those appellate fees should be awarded to the winner at trial?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's, I mean, I think it's a two-part question that you ask. I think first, the rule that we're asking the trial court, or that we're asking this court to write, is simply to affirm that a trial court has the same amount of discretion to award fees for post-verdict work in cases where the fee award is made pursuant to a jury's award of punitive damages as it would in other cases that have been recognized by the 8th District and the sister appellate districts, the 5th and the 9th, as is commonplace in cases where, for example, a fee award is authorized by statute. And to answer the second part of your question, this is a common part of the trial court's process in assessing fees under this court's decision in Bittner and analyzing the Rule 1.5 factors. The question is, what is going to be a reasonable amount to compensate the plaintiffs and deter the misconduct at issue? And no authority of this court has ever drawn a distinction between time reasonably expended on the litigation in the trial court prior to verdict and time reasonably expended in defending that verdict. It's all part of the case. I mean, we're in some ways, we're only asking this court to affirm that the work that is done in this court and the appellate courts on a case is at least as important as the work done in the trial courts. And we respectfully—
Counsel, let me interrupt you, I'm sorry. Are you asking for the contingency amount out of this pot of money, the punitives, or are you asking for hourly rate and number of hours to be determined by the court as to the reasonableness?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. We are asking the court to hold that it is within the trial court's discretion to apply the lodestar calculation, and that lodestar calculation, of course, covers fees before the verdict and after the verdict, because it's all part of the case. And the holistic approach is the only way to fulfill the twin purposes of these fee awards in the first place. So when we do, if and when we end up back in the trial court, we will be asking the trial court to award fees pursuant to the lodestar calculation.
In addition to the 40%, or setting the 40% aside?
The 40% is set aside, Your Honor.
All right. Okay.
Are you asking this rule just for the trial courts? I mean, wouldn't you, if we were to agree with your proposition here, wouldn't you want it to apply to the appellate courts too, such that you could, on appeal, ask the trial court for it? Ask the appellate court for attorney's fees.
Justice Stewart, thank you. That brings up another interesting aspect of this appeal, which is this court's decision in Klein, which gets to the question of where does this end? And in Klein, this court emphasized a practical approach. And that was the term that the court used to say that eventually, if you have parties, it only really takes one party, that just simply refuses to settle a matter, this court has recognized that in certain circumstances, even the appellate court would be authorized to make a reasonable determination of fees incurred on whatever the last appeal may be, simply to just put an end to the proceedings. And we believe that, if it comes to that, that the 8th District would, under Klein, be authorized to say, okay, this is it. This is the limited appeal now. Enough is enough under the practical approach set forth in Klein. We're going to determine a fee award of X amount. And at some point, you know, a plaintiff would be happy to just be done.
And the reason why too that I asked that question is because in this case, it after the first appeal, it went back to the trial court. It was appealed again. It goes back. It was remanded to the trial court, and that's when you ask for the appellate fees. But I'm curious as to whether trial court has jurisdiction to award appellate court fees if a case isn't remanded to the trial court. It would say, under this scenario, I see how you could ask the trial court for appellate for post trial fees, but I'm not sure the jurisdictional aspect of ending at the, for instance, if we hadn't taken this appeal, then if you prevail at the appellate court and it stopped there, could you go back to the trial court to ask for appellate court fees?
I think that the answer to this question kind of shows why Klein allows the flexibility for the appellate court to make a determination of fees. But I believe I would agree that the trial court would not necessarily have jurisdiction to do anything if the case is in the Court of Appeals. The question is whether if the parties don't settle, the plaintiff may file a motion in the appellate court to have the case remanded. I mean, look, practically speaking, 99.99% of these cases will settle. What we're talking about here is the rare case, the extremely rare case where, for whatever reason, a settlement is not reached. And, you know, in those cases, I believe that our courts are well equipped to make these rulings and to make these determinations. This is something that happens all over the country. It happens in cases where fee awards are authorized by statute. It happens in civil rights cases that hold time and time again that these fees, appellate fees, are recoverable, and they must be, or else there are simply grave policy consequences. If you counsel, take the cap counsel, off. Yes.
Counsel, you've used your time.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Mr. Bowles.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Edgar Bowles, representing the Appellees, the English Nanny and Governance Schools, Shayla Roth in Bradford. The appellant here is arguing that this court should fashion some sort of procedural jurisdiction for the award of attorney's fees beyond the trial court into the appellate courts. The decisions, the well-reasoned decisions that have been presented to this court and that I've read, say that this is a matter of jurisdiction which belongs in front of the legislature. It is not right to come to a court and argue that there should be this some sort of hybrid remedy for awarding fees on appeal and awarding fees, as Justice Stewart has pointed out, where there's a question of how this would even mechanically and procedurally work.
Do you have a call holding?
It does not work.
Well, counsel, but let me ask this too. Where is the prohibition of awarding attorney's fees for appellate work?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I look at it the other way, and I ask myself, where is the specific authority for the exercise of that jurisdiction? Appellate courts are courts of limited jurisdiction.
Well, but why can't the authority simply be the fact that if punitive damages are awarded, and that's for specific reasons, malice, public policy concerns, et cetera, we allow the prevailing party to ask for attorney's fees. You can't argue, of course, that an attorney's work at the appellate level is not attorney's fees, as part of the litigation. So when you say, where is there a specific allowance, why isn't it inherent in the fact that attorney's fees are allowable when they're punitive, when there's a punitive damage award?
My answer to that would be that that the courts have jurisdiction only as authorized by the General Assembly. And that's true of the appellate courts, particularly because they're courts of limited jurisdiction. And that the well-reasoned decisions say that there needs to be a statutory grant for such awards. And the appellant's going beyond that and asking for some sort of procedural remedy to be fashioned by this court that would address fees beyond the trial court.
But again, where does it say at the where does it say for trial court litigation? Where is it narrow to that?
Well, my point is that you need a specific authorization to go further than that, to go further than what the statute says.
But Mr. Bowles, in Klein, it wasn't specific that that someone could recover their appellate fees, and we extended it by court decision. So why is that a block to extending the common law?
Klein and other well-reasoned decisions say that where there is a specific statutory authorization for it, that you can proceed that way. But the appellants are not operating within that framework. They're operating within the framework of the common law.
But there was no specific authorization in Klein to award appellate fees. There was a specific statutory authorization.
I submit it's not there. And that's a great impediment.
So are you saying the decision in Klein was wrong?
I do not, but I think that you need to have statutory authorization for this procedural remedy, which the appellant is asking for.
But if we had the authorization, I mean, if you think it wasn't wrong in Klein, where there was a statute for us to say, well, this statute implicitly encompasses appellate fees, why can't we say that for the common law? The statute's just sort of a straw man there.
I believe that's beyond the authorization that comes from the General Assembly.
But Klein dealt with revised code 5321.16, the landlord.
Correct.
There's nothing in that statute that authorizes appellate fees.
Correct.
But they were awarded in Klein.
Correct.
Okay.
I disagree with that on the basis of an application of the law, that without that statutory authorization, I believe it's beyond the authority of a trial court or an appellate court.
So you are saying Klein was wrongly decided?
I'm saying that aspect of its application is, yes.
Okay.
And my understanding with Mr. Novak is that I would take only the first 5 minutes and he would take the remaining time. So I refer over to Mr. Novak.
Thank you, Counselor. May it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Mark Novak. I also, along with Mr. Bowles, am co-counsel for Appalese, English Nanny and Governess School et al. I would pick up where Mr. Bowles left off and also to follow up on the question from Justice Bruner. I believe that Klein was correctly decided and that Klein versus Moots is also directly contrary to the position that appellates are taking in this case. I would emphasize that the Klein court repeatedly throughout its decision and the language of the decision made clear that its extension of the award of appellate fees was based entirely on the existence of as Justice Stewart indicated, ORC section 5321.16c. The syllabus of that case stated, both trial and appellate courts have authority to determine, and tax costs under 5321.16c for attorney's fees incurred at the appellate level. Moreover, in paragraph 13 of that decision, it emphasizes that 5321.16 is a, quote, remedial statute intended to compensate a tenant for a wrongfully withheld deposit at no expense to the tenant. ellipses. Therefore, we hold that a trial court has authority under 5321.16c to tax as costs, excuse me, the attorney's fees incurred at the appellate level. That was the basis, Your Honors, of Klein versus Moots, which I would submit to the court is still good law. And should the court adopt the appellant's position in this case, regardless of what this court does with the American rule, which has been in existence and recognized not only by this court, but by the Supreme Court of the United States dating back until at least to 1796, adopting the appellant's position in this case would essentially eviscerate Klein versus Moots, because the court in that case, as I indicated, made very clear that the rationale for the decision was based on the existence of the remedial Landlord-Tenant Act statute. Of course, there is no such provision here, no statutory provision at all. I know counsel for appellants alluded to the damages cap statute under Ohio Revised Code Chapter 2315. That statute and 532116 are entirely different animals, I would submit.
Whereas let's look at, as Mr. Patakis mentioned earlier, the policy implications behind this. So there's an award of compensatory and punitive damages. They may not be very large awards, but awards nonetheless. The trial court awards attorney fees, the defendant's appeal, which could essentially wipe out an award depending on the size of it. And is it fair, is it appropriate, is it right for the prevailing plaintiff or plaintiffs in that case to then have to either forego the appeal and maybe settle on some amount that is, you know, extremely low, or let all of the money, I mean, the attorneys can't be expected to do it for free, to do the work of defending an appeal for free for the plaintiff. And so doesn't that create an imbalance in positions if the attorneys were allowed to get, and this isn't to say that the attorneys will get attorney fees at the appellate court level. I think what they're asking for is just for the trial court to have discretion, because the trial court might find that the appeal was frivolous and that there was no basis for it, yet and still you're pulling money out of the plaintiff's pocket.
Yes, Your Honor. I thank you for the question. And my response to that would be, again, as is well established here, we do have clients that are not going to be out of pocket of attorney's fees here. As has been well established, both in the briefs and here at oral arguments, these plaintiffs and now appellants were represented by a contingency fee agreement. They are not to date out of pocket, and they will not be out of pocket.
I won't say out of pocket, but at least a loss, a diminution of their awards.
Correct, Your Honor. And when it comes to public policy aspects of the appellant's position, I would reiterate, we included these in our appellee's brief, but I just would like to emphasize for purposes of oral argument that the Ohio courts, as well as the Supreme Court of the United States, has adopted very well-reasoned public policy arguments in favor of the American rule protecting the right of parties. In this case, the public policy aspect would protect appellees from zealously litigating their claims in court. For example, the Supreme Court of the United States in Fleischmann Distilling Corp. versus Meyer Brewing Company in 1967 stated that litigation is at best uncertain, and one should not be penalized for merely defending or prosecuting a lawsuit. I would submit, Your Honor, that should the appellant's position in this case be adopted going forward, giving it in whatever form or fashion, giving the trial court or appellate court discretion to award appellate fees to litigants, that future defendants, not only appellees in this case, would be chilled from challenging potentially unfair punitive damages.
Then that's not necessarily true, because of course the court, if there's a legitimate basis for appeal, then one would suspect that neither the trial court or the appellate court would award those fees. What I think there, what Mr. Patakis, what the appellants in this case are asking for is the ability to ask for them, to not be barred from seeking them. If there's a legitimate defense, absolutely, there's, even if you lose, then in my opinion, award of attorney fees should not be granted. But if appeal is deemed by the appellate court to be frivolous, quite frankly, why shouldn't the plaintiffs be able to, or the appellants be able to compensate, get compensation for the time that they have spent on an appeal that really had no basis from the beginning? And you have a right to appeal, so it's not like coming to this court where we look at the question and grant leave to appeal, grant authority to appeal. You have an appeal as a right at the intermediate level.
Correct, Your Honor. And to that, I would answer that I don't disagree with your question. My response would be that is not this case. This is not the appellees in this case did not prosecute a frivolous appeal. In fact, we were
I'm not saying that it is. I'm not making a determination one way or the other whether the court should have granted the attorney's fees. You're saying that they shouldn't even be able to consider a grant of attorney's fees at the appellate level.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, I would go back to the rationale in the Fleischman case that the Supreme Court granted, saying that again, at when a litigant makes the decision to appeal a case, litigation is an uncertain venture, and the litigant is not going when that litigant makes the decision to appeal, will not be able to see into the future whether the appellate court will ultimately decide whether or not the case was frivolous. I would suggest that if the trial court or appellate court, depending on how such a rule would be fashioned, would present so much uncertainty to an appellate that we would see far less appeals, and just granting the trial court and appellate court this power would open up Pandora's box and essentially entirely reorder the appellate field strategy.
Counselor, just go back to Justice Stewart's question. There's no need for a new rule to allow for fees for frivolous appeals, right? I mean, Appellate Rule 23 says that if the Court of Appeals determines that appeal is frivolous, it may require the appellant to pay the cost of the attorney's fees for the appeal, right?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
So this really has nothing to do with frivolous appeals. This has to do with other types of appeals.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would counter that Appellate Rule 23 makes appellant's argument, I think it renders, it makes appellant's argument unnecessary. In other words, Appellate Rule 23 is out there to deter frivolous appeals, whereas allowing a trial court or appellate court to make awards of appellate fees in light of Appellate Rule 23 would be at best redundant, and at worst, again, would have a chilling effect on non-frivolous appeals and discourage litigants from fully pursuing all avenues of appeal in their case.
Mr. Bevac, if for instance, your parties appealed and they did well in the appeal, it's unlikely that anybody would be talking about attorney's fees, because if you go back to whether it's Ohio or the U.S. Supreme Court, in Ohio under Chambers, or excuse me, in the U.S. Supreme Court, an exception to the American rule is when a party has acted in bad faith, vexatiously, wantonly, or for oppressive reasons. So essentially, I think you probably into. I don't see that it's going to work out the way that you think that it is.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that appellant's position essentially is transposing the punitive damages exception to the American rule with the notion that there has to be, it ignores the fact that there has to be a statutory justification for attorney's fees in the first place. There was no such, obviously no such statute in this case. The underlying case is a common pleas tort case. We cited in our appellee's brief a recent case in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that was, of course, analyzing the case under the law of this honorable court. The case was Braun versus Ultimate Jet Charters LLC. Now, it's an unpublished opinion. We attached that in our brief. The facts in that case were completely on point with this one, in that the plaintiff in that case, successful plaintiff, had pursued a common law tort claim, was awarded punitive damages. The case was subsequently appealed at the federal level to the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit came back and overturned the award of appellate attorney's fees on the punitive damages claim. Again, relying on this honorable court's precedent that was most recently elucidated in Klein versus Moots, which again comes back to our point that deciding this case in the appellant's favor would essentially turn Klein versus Moots on its head, because of the language in that case was so strongly centered upon the existence of 5321.16c. There simply is no equivalent in this case to 5321.16c that authorized legislatively authorized appellate fees in the first place here on
account. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. You've used your time.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Patakis, let me see. You've used your time as well. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to emphasize that their Rule 23 is well established. This case has nothing to do with Rule 23. It does not impact, Rule 23 does not impact the other contexts where appellate fees are available. And it has nothing to do with the twin purposes of these fee awards as part of punitive damages. This isn't about a frivolous appeal. As this court knows, there is a universe of difference between appeals that are frivolous and appeals that are unmeritorious. And these folks had every chance at every stage of these proceedings to reckon with what the evidence was. I was reviewing the transcript last night and thinking to myself what it must have been like for them to prepare for the punitive damages phase of this trial, which was of course bifurcated, knowing that the jury had already held that they were liable for extreme and outrageous conduct that was utterly intolerable in a civilized community. They could have stopped there and made a reasonable settlement offer. They could have stopped with their appeals. I mean, this is not about access to courts. We are talking about an extremely limited subset of cases where the case goes all the way through to a jury. If this court were to accept Appley's invitation to treat fee awards differently in the context of a punitive damages award, you would see a war of attrition in the appellate courts on every single case where defendants were found responsible for this type of conduct. This would
Thank you, Mr. Patakis. Gentlemen, we will take the matter under advisement and you will be notified of our decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.